So we're in chapter 38 of the book of Genesis. This is the 40th lesson. So we're, you would think that we'd be covering everything in great detail, which I guess we probably are. But as we start chapter 38, this is, we sort of changed gears from where we were last week, with that, of course, with Joseph going into captivity or being sold into the into Potiphar's house there in Egypt. And of course you would think the next thing that would happen would be the continuing story of Joseph. Well, we sort of changed gears, and the reason being is because for every sin there is a consequence. And as we've come to find out when dealing with Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob, and now his sons, and the sin of selling Joseph into slavery also has a consequence, and the brothers will pay the consequences throughout their lives, and there's more consequences to come than that which is just dealt with here in chapter 38. That which is here in chapter 38 is specific to the one brother whose name, of course, is Judah. He is the second oldest brother born to Leah, the first wife of Jacob. And it's important to realize that there are those consequences which go on, and of course, in not just collectively as a group of brothers, but also personally, individually, in the lives of people when they engage in sin. So we'll take a look at what happens here, and you'll see that people make their own beds, and then they, of course, have to sleep in them. And you find that so often in life, that people make a way for themselves and get into trouble, and hoping that they can get out of trouble, involve other people, unfortunately, but want somebody else to dig their way out of it for them. But you all have to pay the price for the mistakes that we make. So, and that on an individual basis, not just a collective basis. So here, Judah, he leaves his brothers and decides unwisely in the people that he associates with. Oftentimes throughout life, I'm sure that everybody would agree who's listening, that you've probably, if you think back to the people that you've associated with, the friends that you've had over the course of your life, they've probably been good friends. In other words, that were good in their good for you, in other words. And there were good friends that were bad for you in their association. That really, if you look back, they might have been a lot of fun to be around. But when you think about it, they probably got you in trouble overall. And here is one of those friends of the second category. Probably a guy that was fun to be around, but overall wasn't good for Judah. And probably got him in a lot of trouble. And his name is Hira, and he's a Dulamite, one of the people. He's a Canaanite, which a Dulamite is just a certain type of Canaanite of the land of Canaan. So he's one of the people that the brothers of Jacob and are supposed to keep separate from. Of course, you can do business with them, and you can speak with them, but you're not supposed to pal around with them, and you're not supposed to intermarry with them, such like. But as we read in the first verse, it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. Now, Judah didn't turn into something else, but rather he hung around with this Adullamite. While there, Judah, through the interaction with Hira, the Adullamite friend, he's introduced to a lot of Canaanite women, going out on the town, hanging around in pool halls and bars, things like that. And he sees a girl. And it's when you read the text, the girl is not even named. That's how important she is. If you read, starting in verse 2, Judah saw there was a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. The Canaanite's name was Shua. So, but the daughter's name isn't named at all. So we don't even know the name of his wife. So that's how important this girl's name was. Moses, when he writes Genesis, doesn't even bother to name the particular girl, only the father of the girl. So, and he took her and went in unto her. And she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name Ur. And she conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Shelah. And he was at Shabiz when she bare him. Do you see a pattern here? Any particular pattern? There's lots of sexual activity going on. And that's what the relationship pretty much is based on. Apparently, this certain Canaanite girl was pretty good looking. And Judah was having a pretty good time with her and pretty much wearing her out in the bedroom. Other than that, there's no redeeming qualities that we can pretty much put a finger on, other than the fact that she was fertile and was bearing kid children. That's about all we can really say about her. when you read about the meeting, the one thing that really stuck out, if you compare what Judah, the meeting of the Canaanite woman and Judah, notice Judah saw her, their daughter, whose name was, the father's name there was Shua. He took her and went in unto her. So he saw her, took her, went in unto her. And if you remember what happened to Jacob's daughter, Dinah. Jacob's daughter, Dinah. And of course, that was a very carnal relationship with Hamor the Hivite. When Hamor the Hivite, he had carnal relations with Dinah, and that resulted in all the men of Shechem being slaughtered by the 12 brothers. Well, what happened with Hamor the Hivite when Dinah was around? In chapter 34, verse 2, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, he saw her, he took her, and lay with her, and defiled her. And basically the same thing. Saw her, took her, and went in under her. So it was basically the same type of thing. Ooh, what a pretty girl. He took her and went unto her and had carnal relations. That was what the relationship was based on. You know, the whole love, lust at first sight. And Judah was that kind of guy. Yes, as Shinobi says, still goes on today. You're exactly right. Still goes on today. yeah, more often than you or I probably know. And so, without getting graphic, you're exactly right. But meanwhile, there was absolutely no spiritual considerations taken into account with this woman. She was just good looking and apparently easy to get into bed. So, as the boys grew, she bore three sons to Judah. And as the boys grew up and got old enough to marry, there was a girl named Tamar. I believe that's probably how you pronounce that. And Tamar, she was acquired as a wife for Ur, the oldest son. But as it turns out, Ur was so wicked that God slew him. Now, why is it that, let's just pause here for a minute. Well, we'll read the verse in Genesis 38:6. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. That's the wife's name. And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. Well, okay, so Ur was wicked. He was so wicked, as a matter of fact, that the Lord decided he had to get rid of Ur and slay him. Now, what would lead to someone being so wicked that the Lord says he's just too wicked to even be on the face of the earth? What kind of upbringing do you suppose would lead to that? Well, I'm just imagining, in my experience, let's take me back to shopping at Walmart, for instance, and I can just imagine some of the women that I've seen in Walmart with three or four children in tow, and they're all screaming, and mom's screaming back at them, and there's a scream fest going on, and the kids are yanking on mom, and they're running around and yelling, and they're grabbing the candy, and mom's screaming back at them, and I can just imagine when they get home that the father's probably not there. He's out drinking at the bar or having a good time with his buddies down at the pool hall. And when he gets home, he's probably too drunk to care, so he just goes on to bed. And that's pretty much the home life that these children have. And so they'll grow up and be wicked too, just like her. And if the Lord was still slaying people at random, he would look at most of those kids from the Walmart scene and slay them dead, just as he slayed her. But meanwhile, Ursulin, yeah, no moral upbringing, exactly right, as Betty says. So his sins were not detailed, but we can just fill in the blanks for ourselves. But what happened, though, we dealt with the birthright issue before, and we will deal with it again. The headship, or the birthright, would have gone to him being the firstborn of the oldest children of Judah. Well, with being now dead, who's the next in line? Onan. That's the next oldest son of the family of the sons of Judah. And so Judah tells Onan, well, you go to Tamar to produce children to carry on the family name. And as you read verse 8, we'll do that together. Judah said unto Onan, go into thy brother's wife and marry her and raise up seed to thy brother. Now remember, marriage was not a big deal at this time. It wasn't a huge ceremony. It was basically you go in and you spend the night and have consensual relations one with another, and you're married. So that's what it amounted to. Well, where did that idea come from, and was the biblical idea that the younger brother should then go into the older brother's wife, or even vice versa? But another brother take on the widow of the dead brother's wife, and yeah, sort of common law, but even more than that, yeah. But it was in fact a biblical concept. It was, in fact, a biblical concept, and it later even became written into what is the law of Moses. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 25, starting here in verse 5, and that details this particular law. It says, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child, well, then the family name of that particular brother is going to die out, you see. Well, so what happens? The wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother, which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. So, in other words, Onan here, that's being the second son of Judah, would have gone in and gotten Tamar pregnant, and the first son that would have been produced by Tamar, that son's name would have been named Ur, that his name would have gone on. So, that's how that would have worked. And verse 7 says, if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, my brother refuseth to raise up his brother a name in Israel and will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. And then the elders of the city shall call him and speak unto him and say, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to do, Jack? And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face. And shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto the man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. Which, if you have to sign a whole lot of documents, is a long name. The house of him who hath his shoe loosed. Well, nobody wants to sign that name. So, Onan's thinking, I don't want to have to sign that, so I better go in and do my duty. Well, but the bad thing about it is, Onan is kind of a conniving young man, and he knows something. He knows that any children that are produced from the union of him to his older brother's wife, Tamar, would in fact be as they were the children of her, his older brother. And they would retain the birthright. So the birthright would pass from his older brother to the offspring that would be produced. And he's thinking to himself, well, now this just isn't right, because it wouldn't be my kid. It wouldn't be treated as my child. So, Onan practices a sort of a crude form of birth control. You can't help but laugh, Betty. I'm sorry, hey, it's the Bible. What can I tell you? He practices sort of a crude form of birth control, and he and Tamar are there together, and he's doing his duty to a point, and I say that to a point, but here Onan knew, verse 9, that the seed should not be his. In other words, the offspring that are produced from the union would not be his, but rather his older dead brothers. And it came to pass that when he went in unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest that he should give seed to his brother. So things didn't necessarily come to completion, in other words. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord. Therefore, he slew him also. So the Lord did away with Onan because of the evil intent of Onan to keep his brother's widowed wife from conceiving a child. Well, Onan's motivation was evil, and it was self-centered, and he wanted to... not laughing now, are you? It was self-centered, and because he wanted to get the privileges of the birthright that should have been the older brother's and then been passed on to the offspring of the older brother's wife. And he was being disobedient to his father, which of course was not a good thing. He was also dishonoring his brother, his older brother, Ur. Well, of course, God doesn't like that, so he did what he had to do. These being the offspring of the unnamed Canaanite woman, and did away with it. Yeah, as Genesis turns, exactly right, the new soap opera, which is coming to a channel near you. Meanwhile, there's one more son. One more son, the youngest son, Shelah. And Judah seems to not want to sacrifice his youngest son, Shelah. So he says, well, Shelah isn't old enough to go in unto this woman. So we're going to just wait a while. And meantime, she can just hang around and be a widow until the time when he gets old enough, and then things can go on as they as they should, and Shelah can then be married to Tamar, and on we go. But what happens is quite different than what Judah had in mind. Verse 11, which is not in your outline, then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow at thy father's house till Shelah my son be grown." For he said, "Lest peradventure he die also, as his brethren did." And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So Judah just told Tamar to wait on the notion that, you know, that the third son wasn't old enough, but he was promised to her. Well, over the course of time, you know, the younger son gets older and older and older, and over the course of time, Judah continues to withhold the younger son, Shelah, from Tamar, fearing that he would also die if he were married to her. So, that's the point that we're at now. Well, in Tamar's society, now this is a Canaanite society, and it's very sexually oriented, very, I guess you would say, a very perverted society, kind of like the United States. That would be reasonable to say. So, you know, everything was really revolved around the producing of children, and the sexual mores were quite different than, you know, we're used to today. Not only could the younger brother raise up seed for the older brother, but also the father-in-law was eligible to do so. And, of course, who's the father-in-law? That's Judah. Well, so because Judah is withholding his youngest son, Shelah, from Tamar, she takes matters into her own hands, wanting to have a son so that her dead husband, could have his name carried on. You know, she's not getting any younger, and the years are passing on. So she concocts a plan, and she takes matters into her own hands, as you might say. So when we pick up the story, what's going on is Judah departs. He leaves town after the death of his Canaanite wife. Now, we still don't know her name, but she dies. So now Judah is a widower. He's a freewheeling bachelor. But he is still friends with his friend, Kerah, and he goes to Tanath to go sheep shearing. Now, there's a party if I ever heard one. Let's go sheep shearing, buddy. But sheep shearing probably was, in its own way, sort of a manly type of gathering, which was you know, just a festival of you're shearing sheep all day. What do you do at night? You get together, you party, you drink, you have a good time, that type of thing. It's a guy thing, as Betty says. You're exactly right. So, here's two guys. They're both friends, and they're off to the sheep shearing festival. Well, on the way, verse 12, Genesis 38, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. The unknown named daughter. So she's dead, and Judah was comforted. Apparently it didn't take too much to comfort him, because we didn't even know her name. And went up unto his sheep shearers to Timnath, and to his friend Hira the Adullamite. So he's ready to have a good old time. Well, Tamar learns that Judah's going. And she knows what this whole festival, this whole sheep shearing business is all about. She knows that Men are going to be there. Yeah, sort of like a honey party. You're exactly right. She knows that men are going to be there. They're going to be having a good time. They're going to be looking for a good time. And she knows her father-in-law, Judah, what he's all about and what kind of guy he is. So she comes up with a plan. In verse 13, it was told Tamar, saying, "Behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Timnath to shear his sheep." And she put her widow's garments off from her and covered her with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given unto him to wife. In other words, what's she doing? Well, in today's language, it would be she took off her nice clothes, and she put on a halter top and short shorts and high heels, and hung out, you know, and walked up and down the sidewalk on Main Street. What would we call that girl? Streetwalker clothes. Exactly right. You're the winner. Streetwalker clothes. See, yeah, Daisy Dukes. There's exactly right. Streetwalker clothes. Daisy Dukes. Well, the streetwalker clothes of that particular time was a veil. Instead of walking the street, she just sat there in the open place. And as Judah and his buddy Hera go walking by, the Adullamite, they're having a good time. They're all ready to have themselves just a fine time. And they spot her. So Judah spots what he perceives to be a he sees what he perceives to be a prostitute by the road, and by the language that Judah uses, it really suggests that he had had dealings with prostitutes before, and he knew how to handle the negotiations, he knew how to handle the arrangements, he knew all about it. He had done this before. There was no naivete in the way that he addressed her and the way that he set up everything. So as we read in Genesis 38:15, when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. And he turned unto her by the way and said, "Go to, I pray thee, let me come in unto thee." For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What wilt thou give me that thou mayest come in unto me?" How much are you paying me, in other words? And he said, "I will send thee a kid from the flock." Sort of putting on his MasterCard, you know, "I don't have anything right now, but we can charge it." And she said, "Wilt thou give me a pledge till you send it?" And he said, "What pledge shall I give thee?" And she said, "Thy signet, and thy bracelets, and thy staff that is in thine hand." And he gave it to her, and came in unto her, and she conceived by him. Now, why did she ask for those specific items? Because those particular items, the signet, the bracelets, and the staff, were all items that were specific to the man. The signet would have been the thing that they used for personalizing a seal, for signing documents and things like that. The bracelet would have been made just for Judah, and it would have been personalized, as would have been the staff. That would have been something unique that he had. Yeah, exactly right. So those things would have been identifiable to Judah as his. And the signet would have been identifiable as his by others. So those things would have been a guarantee of payment. because it would have been valuable. It would be like handing a credit card to somebody. Well, so she arose, verse 19, and went away and laid by her veil from her and put on the garments of her widowhood. So she took off the hooker clothes and put her widow garments back on. Well, you know that Judah's friend Hera was there, the Adullamite, and was there during all the negotiations, saw the girl as the hooker sitting by the road, and probably encouraged Judah to go on and have a good time, because when it's time to deliver payment, Judah sends him with the goat, the kid from the flock, to pay the girl. In verse 20, Judah sent the kid by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he found her not. And so Hera gets sort of it's sort of embarrassing, because he's looking around everywhere, and then he finally has to ask, where's this girl at? And in verse 21, then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot that was openly by the wayside? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. And he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. And also the men of the place said that there was no harlot in this place. Well, that's sort of embarrassing. You don't want to go through town asking everybody, where's the harlot that I was with? Where's that prostitute I had with me all night long? I'm trying to find her so I can pay her. So Judah decides to keep it quiet and see what happens, just to let the matter die down, to avoid embarrassment and anything else going on. So in verse 23, Judah said, let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I sent this kid, and thou hast not found her. Well, 3 months go by. 3 months go by. And I'm sure that as time went on, Judah probably thought, well, she left town, maybe she got killed, maybe she had a change of heart, this, that. He probably forgot all about it. Probably put it out of his mind. Then, suddenly one day, Judah gets word that Tamar is pregnant by prostituting herself. Even then, I've got to imagine, it probably never entered his mind. There was probably never even a flash connecting the two events together. So, when he gets this word, it came to pass, verse 24, about 3 months after, that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar thy daughter-in-law hath played the harlot, and also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth, and let her be burnt. So it probably never even occurred to him at that time, which really speaks to his frame of mind. And when you're in the frame of mind where you're not feeling guilty about sin, where it's just an everyday occurrence, where partying and sinning and going about all these things is just normal. That one occurrence doesn't stand out in your mind. And it probably wasn't bothering him at all. And when it's announced that his daughter-in-law is pregnant because of whoredom and because of being a harlot, he probably didn't make the connection. Because that one occurrence, he'd forgotten about it. It was just one of many. Well, she has to defend herself. And she does so by taking the signet, the bracelets, and the staff that were given to her by Judah and sending them to Judah. Verse 25, when she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man whose these are, am I with child." And she said, "Discern, I pray thee, whose are these, the signet, the bracelets, and staff." She didn't publicly accuse Judah, which that is to her credit. Most people would have just publicly announced, "It's Judah's child, and here's the proof." And she could have done that. But she sent the evidence to him to weigh. And upon weighing the evidence, Judah doesn't comment on the morality of what she's done, only that she acted in her own interest in getting the son that was rightfully hers. Verse 26, and Judah acknowledged them, those articles were his, and said, "She hath been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah, my son, and she knew her, and he knew her again no more." Maybe Judah had a moral epiphany at that time. By knowing her no more, maybe he had a turnaround and realized the gravity of his sin. It's hard to tell. Oftentimes, once we're caught and once we're found out in our sin, it hits home. Up until that time, we think we're getting away with everything and just continue on until we actually do get caught. The consequence of this union between Tamar and Judah, of course, is a pregnancy, and the result of the pregnancy is that twins are born. The first that puts his hand out during the delivery, one puts his hand out, and the midwife takes a scarlet thread and ties around the wrist of the one who sticks his hand out, and the hand is pulled back in, and then the other is born breech first. The one with the scarlet thread is born second. So as we read in Genesis 38, verse 27 and 28, verses 27 through the end of the chapter, as a matter of fact, it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she travailed that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, "This came out first." And it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out. And she said, "How hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee." Therefore his name was called Perez. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Now, if you look at your Bible at Matthew chapter 1, Perez is the lineage of the Lord Jesus Christ passes through these through Judah. And it's very interesting. If you read, starting at the beginning, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, Abraham begat Isaac. Now, did Isaac have a brother? He did, which was Ishmael, but Ishmael is not mentioned. And Isaac begat Jacob. Now, did Jacob have a twin? he did, which was Esau. And Esau wrestled with him in the womb. And Jacob was the second to be born, and Jacob was holding on to Esau as they came out, but Esau is not mentioned. And Jacob begat Judas and his brethren, which is Judah. And Judah begat Perez and Zerah of Thamar. And so there's Perez and Zerah right there. So both Perez and Zerah are mentioned. But Perez, if you keep reading, Perez begat Esrom, Esrom begat Aram, and on goes the genealogy. But it's interesting that only in this instance, where it has Judah begatting Perez and Zerah, the two brothers, both of the brothers are mentioned, which is just a strange instance in the genealogy. I wanted to point that out to you, to point this out to you. That when you read verses 29 and 30, there's some... yeah, you're right, Betty. That's a fact. Yeah, both twins are mentioned. but when you read verses 29 and 30 in the book of Genesis, chapter 38, it's interesting language. It came to pass as he drew his back his hand that, behold, his brother came out, and she said, this is the midwife, "How hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee." Therefore, his name was called Perez. So, this breach be upon thee, upon Perez, and then afterwards, the one with the scarlet thread is born, whose name is Zerah. And there is a possible explanation for the breach and the scarlet thread. You need to take it with a grain of salt, of course. Some things in the Bible need to be taken with a grain of salt. But here, there is a possible explanation for the breach and the scarlet thread. At the time that the Babylonians invaded Jerusalem, of course there were kings. There was a throne and a scepter that was from the line of David, that was from the line of Perez, actually. Because the line of Perez led to the line of led to David, who was king, and Solomon, and then on forward. And Zedekiah was the last king of Israel from the line of Perez. And all, if you look at 2 Kings 25:7, as the Babylonians were sacking Jerusalem, they slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and bound him with fetters of brass, and carried him to Babylon. From there he never returned. He died. He died. Even the king's daughters get taken captive, and eventually they're with Jeremiah, and you can read Jeremiah 41:1 through 43:13, and you can read the story about the daughters, the king's daughters. They get taken captive, and then they get rescued, and God's will is that they do not go to Egypt, but when they get that report, they call Jeremiah a false prophet, and they go to Egypt anyway, where God has said that anyone who goes to Egypt will be kind of slain, and they go to Egypt anyway. So the daughters and the sons and Zedekiah, which is the end of the line as far as Perez, they're all killed from the Babylonians. So at the end of the line of Perez, there is no biblical evidence for this, but many believe that the scepter, that there was a breach in the scepter, and that's why you see this breach be upon thee in Genesis 38:29. Therefore his name was called Perez. There was a breach in the line of kings, and the breach is healed by the offspring of Zerah, who had the scarlet thread tied upon him. They are mentioned in Genesis 49:12 going into Egypt, the offspring of Zerah, and then coming out of Egypt in Numbers 26:13-20. So they were in Egypt, and then they came out of Egypt. And Zerah is a part of Judah. They're the offspring of Judah. And Genesis 49:10, the prophecy is only that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him should be the gathering of the people be. Whether you read it or realize it or not, Shiloh has come with the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. And now, of course, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords rules in heaven. And he, of course, was from the tribe of Judah. He was the lion of the tribe of Judah. Since the Lord's come, there is no need of an earthly throne. But after the Babylonian captivity, there is no record of a throne. So you have to believe that God took care of that. The only evidence that could be biblical for the offspring of Zerah is that in Nehemiah 11:24 you find that Pethahiah the son of Meshezebel of the children of Zerah, the son of Judah, was at the king's hand in all matters concerning the people. So the children of Zerah, if you read that chapter in Nehemiah, they're very widespread and very active. There's lots of them very active and right in the thick of things. So it's very possible that they could have taken the crown at some point. So it's hard to say. That's just a theory. The bad part about that theory, I have a few minutes before the top of the hour, I will include this also. The bad thing about that theory is that there's no biblical evidence for it. So like I say, you have to take it with a grain of salt. So we have no evidence whether the offspring of Perez continued to sit on the throne, or whether it was taken over by Zerah, the offspring of Zerah. It makes no difference, because by faith, you just need to believe that the scepter did not depart from Judah and his sons. On the other hand, that theory that the throne did depart from Perez and move to the offspring of Zerah has unfortunately led quite erroneously to what's called British Israelism, because they go beyond the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ bodily and take it to the Queen of England and all that. the royal, you know, the royal throne in the British Isles. So you cannot get carried away with all that garbage. You have to believe the Bible for what it says, that the scepter shall not depart from Judah till Shiloh come. Well, Shiloh has come. The Lord Jesus Christ was here bodily in the flesh and ascended into heaven, where he is seated at the right hand of God the Father. He is on the throne in heaven, and he was the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So there's no doubt that there is a descendant of Judah on the throne at this time, and always will be. So since the Lord has come, that has been taken care of. There's just a very few number of years where the Bible doesn't cover that we don't know. So, you know, that's just a possibility there for those couple of verses. You know, what does that mean, that the breach be upon thee? Why was the scarlet thread? You can just use your imagination and wonder. That's a possible answer. That's all that means.